Welcome to the fourth season of Version 20 Podcast, where I, Bobby Stevens, am your host with a new episode every Wednesday. If you are a serious fan of true crime and love listening to podcasts, but don't want all that small talk, you've come to the right place. We get right to the facts. Murder in 20 episodes are concise and complete in 20 minutes. Less talk and more true crime. Be sure to like, share, and follow us to learn about upcoming episodes every Wednesday. Thanks for tuning in. Now let's get to this week's episode. The Canadian Forces established an airbase in North Bay, Ontario in 1951. In 1963, NORAD opened an operation center that was an astonishing 60 stories underground. Much of it was demolished in the 1990s when the federal government cut back operations. However, its runways built to handle the military's largest aircraft remained. They were put to use on September 11, 2001, when the terrorist attacks launched on the U.S. forced international flights to land in North Bay. Tess Ritchie and her four older sisters grew up in North Bay. Being the baby of the family, Tess was sweet and outgoing. They lovingly referred to her as their number five. She loved her dogs and was very close with her sisters and mother Christine. Tess had dreams of spreading her wings and becoming a flight attendant, a chance to see the world. She moved 200 miles to the big city of Toronto. But even though the miles now separated them, Tess kept in touch daily with her family. She worked serving tables while pursuing her future and completed a flight attendant course at college. In late November 2017, 20-year-old Tess was distraught over a breakup with her boyfriend. She turned to her big sister Rachel for moral support. Rachel spent the day at Tess's. They went shopping and shared some conversation. That evening, it was Friday, and Tess wanted to get her mind off things and have some fun. So she made arrangements with an old high school friend, Riley Samar, who had also moved to Toronto. They hadn't seen each other in a couple years, and it would be a fun night of catching up. Tess dressed in black tights, a black sweater, high-heeled boots, and a green army jacket. Riley suggested they go to a well-known gay bar in the Church and Wellesley area. Rachel watched as Tess ran down the sidewalk to meet the Uber for the ride into downtown. She arrived at the bar just before midnight. It was packed. While she waited for Riley, she texted her sister that she safely made it. Riley arrived soon after. The two girls shared a hug and grabbed a drink. Out on the dance floor, the girls were having fun, and the liquor flowed. But Tessa's small frame had her feeling the effects. At only 5'2" and not much over 100 pounds, she had started to become unsteady and bumped into people. This got the attention of security, and just after 2 a.m., she and Riley were asked to leave. Tess wasn't too happy about that and argued to stay, but the bouncer guided her towards the door. Intoxicated Tess left the bar, hanging on to the railing as she stumbled down the steps. Kaylin Schlater exited the bar. He'd arrived around the same time as the girls, but was mingling in different circles. At 21, he hung out in gay bars, in hopes of picking up women who'd let their guard down. He had an obsession with violent, non-consensual relations, including choking, something he'd experimented with, but only on a consenting basis. Gay bars weren't the only way he used to meet women. He found dating apps too easy, so he cruised the art galleries, and for a time was a nude life model at the university, and used his position to sleep with art students. Throughout the evening, he'd had brief conversations with a number of women, but none of his efforts panned out. A timeline provided by court records revealed that after 20 minutes, Tess and Riley started walking down Church Street. Kaylin wasn't far behind and caught up to them. Riley recognized him from earlier. Tess was ready to call it a night and go home. As a cab drove by, she waved it down, but Kaylin waved it off. The threesome continued walking a few blocks, and at the intersection of Dundonald Street, stopped at a hot dog stand. Kaylin paid for the hot dogs while the girls added the condiments. Riley got carried away and spread mustard all over the vendor's cart. Laughing hysterically, the trio bolted. A couple doors down, Michelle Teep was outside in her front yard when she heard the loud laughter. Tess apologized to her for disturbing her and introduced them. Soon Tess was confiding in her about her breakup. Michelle told her to hang in there. Things will get better. After 20 minutes, Riley got a text from her boyfriend asking her to come home. She nudged Tess, saying she needed to get going. But Tess wasn't ready to leave and became upset. CBC News reported that Kaylin walked over to Tess, put his hand on her shoulder, and told Michelle, "I've got this. It's okay." The threesome continued on, but not before Tess and Michelle exchanged phone numbers. Riley headed towards College Street to catch a streetcar. Tess turned back towards Church Street. Kaylin followed. Standing at 50 Dundonald Street, it was 4:02 a.m. Tess called for an Uber. A notification popped up on her mother's phone back in North Bay. The Uber account had been set up with her credit card. Kaylin approached Tess, and the two sat down on a bench at the corner of Church and Dundonald. Kaylin said something to Tess that convinced her to go for a walk. Minutes later, the two walked around the corner and back onto Church Street. A few doors down, the Heritage Home was under restoration. Built in 1878, its red brick exterior extended up two floors, while the third was covered in a dark slate. Its many arched windows gave it a stately manner. 12 minutes later, the Uber arrived. The driver texted Tess twice. At 4:14 a.m., when he did not receive an answer, he canceled the trip and charged her a cancellation fee. Cradled between the Heritage Home and its tall neighbor was a long, narrow driveway that led to a side door at the back. Stairs with a thin iron railing led up to the side door. Beneath it was an open cement stairwell that led to a locked door in the basement. This is where Kaylin and Tess ended up. The two kissed and began to get intimate. Kaylin wanted more, but Tess wasn't interested and said no. But Kaylin wouldn't take no for an answer and persisted. Acting out his fantasy, he put pressure on Tess's neck and strangled her. Tess died at 22. Kaylin dove into her purse, retrieved a necklace, and stole money to get back home. Back to a house he shared with his parents and younger brother. The next morning, Rachel texted her sister. When there was no answer, she thought she must be sleeping. But when she hadn't heard from Tess by 6 p.m., she sensed something was wrong and started making calls. Her calls to Tess went straight to voicemail. She called the hospitals, then reported her missing to police. Police didn't initially take much interest in Tess's case, and her disappearance sparked fear among the members of Toronto's Gay Village. There was an increase in missing cases at the time, It would turn out that many were the victims of Bruce MacArthur, a serial killer we featured in the second season of our podcast, titled A Serial Gardener. Rachel and her sisters searched Tessa's apartment and visited where she worked. They called her friends and ex-boyfriends. They made up posters with photos of Tess and plastered them in the area where she was last seen. Tessa's 23rd birthday was coming up in a few days, and they were desperate to get back their number 5. Members of Toronto's Police Services Neighborhood Community Watch Program were searching the streets looking for Tess. Tessa's mother, Christine Hermiston, traveled from North Bay and joined her daughters in the search. On November 29, the day before Tessa's 23rd birthday, she was joined by her friend Anne Brousseau. They put up posters in the area where Tess had vanished. As they walked by 582 Church Street, Anne ventured down the driveway towards a stairwell. Glancing down, she stopped. Her breath ceased when she realized what she saw. She immediately recognized Tess laying at the bottom of the stairs. Next to her was her pink purse and cell phone. Her face was blue, with a wound above her left eye. Bruises were visible on her hands, wrists, and arms. Anne turned and retreated down the driveway and called out to Christine. She ran to the stairs, stopped dead in her tracks, and let out a blood-curdling scream. The members of the community search team around the corner heard Christine scream. Moments later, they heard the call on the radio and rushed over. Tess was found only 300 feet from where she was last seen. Tess's mother called her daughter Rachel to give her the news that would forever change their lives. Their number 5 was gone. At Tess's autopsy, it was determined she died from strangulation. DNA samples were taken and sent to the lab. Public opinion criticized the Toronto police for not finding Tess, for not doing their job, alleging that they had not canvassed the neighbors and had not conducted a proper search. Later, 2 police officers were charged with misconduct, and an independent review led by a former judge found discrimination by the Toronto police contributed to deficiencies in a number of missing persons investigations, including Tess's. Detectives began gathering video surveillance from the surrounding area. With many cameras in the area, they were able to track Tess and Riley and saw that they were later joined by an unknown male. Video tracked Tess and the male up until 4:15 a.m., when they were seen walking hand in hand. Then they moved outside of the camera range. 45 minutes later, the male was seen on the same camera, walking alone. On December 10th, police held a press conference and released images of the unknown male. Caitlin recognized himself in the photos and called police. Police picked him up at his parents. They, along with a lawyer, joined him at the station for questioning. While waiting, Caitlin drank a bottle of water that his parents brought for him, then discarded it. He refused to talk to detectives and was allowed to leave. Detectives quickly retrieved the empty water bottle and sent it for DNA testing. While police waited for the DNA results from Tess and Caitlin to come back, they kept Caitlin under surveillance. On February 3, 2018, 2.5 months after Tess's murder, the DNA results came back. A match. Detectives tracked Caitlin down to a movie theater where he's watching the Super Bowl with his parents. Kalin was arrested and charged with first-degree murder and taken to his cell at the police station. Werdegan prearranged that he would be placed between two cells occupied by undercover officers. Placed in three cells side by side, with Kalin in the middle, they could see through the cell bars into the hallway, but could not see each other. The three held conversations throughout the night, talking about football and girls. When asked why he was in jail, Kalin admitted that he'd done something big, really bad. Then, he confessed to killing Tess. Later, when Kalin was moved to a cell at the Toronto Detention Center, he met a fellow prisoner who took him under his wing. Kalin used his cellmate as a sounding board and bounced potential alibis off him. But his cellmate was disgusted that Kalin showed no remorse for Tess or her family and was only concerned about himself, so he alerted police. Kalin's trial in March 2020 began just as the COVID pandemic swept across the globe and was delaying many trials, but the jury chose to forge ahead. The judge ordered that the evidence of Kalin's violent sexual behavior be excluded, as it would be prejudicial. In court, Kalin appeared soft-spoken and showed no remorse. His lawyer tried to throw suspicion on another man, but the DNA evidence found on Tess's body pointed only to Kalin. The undercover officers testified along with Kalin's cellmate, who had not been given any special consideration for his testimony. After 7 weeks, the jury reached a verdict: guilty. In handing down the ruling, the judge stated in part, "The jury found you guilty of first-degree murder without knowing what I know about you. But I know it, and I will not be blind to it. Your sexual appetite led you to literally take an innocent young woman by the hand down a path to her death." And he added, "I could not fail to observe you shed no tears." Kalin automatically received a life sentence with no chance of parole for 25 years.
Thanks for listening to Murder in 20 with Less Talk and More True Crime.
Be sure to tune in next Wednesday for the episode of Philippa Drow. On a small island in the Atlantic, the locals make their living fishing lobster. But when a petty thief went too far, those he stole from took matters into their own hands, and their actions forever divided a community.
If you're dying to hear more, past episodes of Murder in 20 are available for free at murderin20.com. and on all major podcast platforms. We love what we do and are dying to continue. If you enjoy listening to Murder in 20 every week, we'd be eternally grateful for your support by visiting Murder in 20 at Patreon, PayPal, or murderin20.com. We'd like to acknowledge Verbal Planet for use of their music, sound effect from Vaseline Studios and Quick Sounds, and our many editorial sources who are listed on our website. Be sure to like, share, and follow us to learn about upcoming episodes every Wednesday. Stay safe, sleep with the lights on, and don't play with strangers.